I know why you are all out there with your radios tuned to 88.5 at 2:06 in the afternoon. You, like those of us in this studio, are political junkies. You cannot wait to continue conversations about what's happening both in the presidential race, in state and local politics, and we're going to provide all of that for you right now as Political Rewind kicks off our Wednesday edition. With me, as he always is Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read him in the paper on Thursdays and Sunday. He's working right now on trying to get a column out. And some come easier than others, right, Jim?
This one isn't.
Well, we'll look forward to it. He also, of course, oversees Political Insider, the blog that you'll find at AJC.com that keeps you up to date on politics. One of the contributors to Political Insider, as well as a frequent byline throughout the AJC, is Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the AJC. It's great to have you here, Greg.
Glad to be here.
And we're also joined by Leo Smith. He is the Minority Engagement Director of the Georgia Republican Party. And in the past week, he made a prediction that has caused him to suddenly be in the eye of attention, not just here in Atlanta and in Georgia, but around the country. He's predicting 20% of black voters are going to cast their ballots for Donald Trump. Can't wait to talk to you about that at some point in this show, Leo.
Looking forward to it.
And also, we're joined by Howard Franklin. He's a Democratic political consultant who's done a lot of work in local races. He has been involved in a Democratic National Convention in the past. You heading back to Philadelphia for the convention, right?
I will be, yes.
All right. All right. So thank you all for being here. There's a lot of presidential politics to discuss, particularly coming out of Kentucky last night. But I really think we need to start, Jim Galloway, with the issue that, you know, there are all these social issues that simply don't go away in this state. Gay marriage was one of them. Religious liberty was another one. Campus carry. And now the issue that has risen to the surface is
who gets to go to which bathroom?
Yeah. The Obama administration, as we know, has really opened an aggressive front on this issue. First, by telling the state of North Carolina they would withhold federal funding because North Carolina had essentially nullified Charlotte's effort to allow transgender people to use the bathroom that they feel is appropriate to their gender. And then issuing a ruling that schools across the country, public schools, had to allow transgender students to choose the bathroom that fits who they believe they are from a gender point of view.
It was a letter of what was the phrase? Significant advice from the White House. And that word significant is what carried the implied threat of withheld federal funds. And basically what this letter has done is it's really nationalized an issue that that was at least to a large part regional, held into South Carolina. And you have every school board in the country now and the parents of the students in that school system looking over this directive and saying, what does it mean here?
Yeah, Greg Bluestein, we have to wonder, first of all, you know, we have this continuing struggle in this country with understanding the role that the federal government ought to or ought not to play in education in the states. And of course, there's a strong feeling that the feds, for the most part, need to stay out of education. In this case, you have to wonder how much the Obama administration has put this on the map because they're looking at it as a great issue in the November election.
And for Republicans, it's a great issue in next Tuesday's primaries. Yeah. I mean, this was an opportune time for Georgia's Republicans. This was red meat. And that's why we saw so much backlash from Republican candidates who were up in arms. And it was very interesting. It took Governor Deal and Sam Olens, Attorney General Sam Olens, 3 or 4 days to respond. And in this sort of atmosphere, that's a lifetime. But you saw that most of Georgia Senate Republicans wrote a letter to both of them saying, we want you to take concrete action. We want you to sue the federal government to try to block this directive from taking effect. And we also want you to assure local school districts that you will defend them if they ignore the directive.
And in those statements, neither Olins nor Deal mentioned any kind of that legal action. And if look, if you're Sam Olins or you're Nathan Deal, you don't want to be wagged by 181 school systems. Yeah. I don't think that's going to happen.
So, but what you have here is this has opened up several fronts right here in Georgia. Number one, as you point out, we got a letter. A news release, essentially, from Governor Deal, in which, as you point out, Greg, he's very careful. He basically he says he doesn't think the federal government ought to have a role in determining bathrooms or a lot of other aspects of what goes on in Georgia schools. And he's not happy about this. But as you point out, he never, ever comes close to saying we ought to sue over this. We ought to enter into whatever lawsuits might go forward against the administration
on
this.
And remember, about a dozen Republican governors, I think even more than that, had already come out against it. So he was under mounting pressure to say something. And he kind of did, I guess, sort of the bare minimum. He came out, criticized the Obama administration, called it a federal overreach, said that this could be a dangerous policy, but then said it really wasn't up to the state to take any action. It would be up to the 181 school districts to determine how they should do.
And you've got a group, what is the group? The group is called Concerned Women for America of Georgia, involving many of the same people who were involved in the religious liberty fight of this last session. And they're actually somewhat critical of the governor for what they're calling a hands-off attitude on this.
Yeah, and we should also say, on another front, Josh McCoon, Senator McCoon from Columbus, has suggested that he very well might introduce legislation at the beginning of the next session in which he will allow, is the word that I read in the quote, the state to take action, legal action, against. The legislation would allow the state to move forward with some sort of legislation.
Well, the other thing he's talking about legislation that would remove sovereign immunity for the state. If you're the parent of a child who has been assaulted or molested by a transgendered person, you would be able to move into court faster.
All right, let's get to the politics of this. Greg has already mentioned Howard and Leo that this is red meat for especially incumbent Republicans who are running for legislature, particularly, although I suppose it comes into play in some of the primary challenges in Congress, especially where we've got people like Barry Loudermilk being challenged from the right, believe it or not. Leo, what's your take on this? Is the governor, in a way, helping to put something out there that will give those legislators who might have been in trouble over campus carry getting vetoed, religious liberty getting vetoed, is this giving them something they can work with?
I think so. And I think that, as you said, is going to be really important. It looks like political strategy in some ways to create all these social issues right now seems to be the current trend of being more liberal with social issues in Georgia in some ways, and to put our legislators in a place where they have to advocate for their voters.
Yeah, I sort of agree with that. I mean, I think the issue would exist and would be red meat, whether or not the governor and the attorney general waded into it. If they had agreed to sign on and create a lawsuit, I think we'd still have folks, you know, rallying against the Obama administration. To me, the question is, how long does this fervor last? This past legislative session, we had folks, you know, hurriedly finishing those 40 legislative days, getting ready to get out and campaign and doubling down on their conservative bona fides. Will they need to do this next year when there's no election looming, or will we take a longer look at some of the issues and the implications?
All right, but let me throw this out, too, if I may, and you're all welcome to jump in on this. While this is one of those hot-button issues in terms of social conservatives who want to, you know, bar the door against this sort of the concerns they have about transgender individuals using a bathroom that isn't their birth, what's on the sex that's on their birth certificate, is there not, in fact, a legitimate constitutional question also at stake here, Leo, in terms of the president's right to demand schools do what the administration wants them to and threaten to withhold federal funds as a result. Is this administration overreach?
Well, it is administration overreach, and not just because of the Constitution, but also because it's the wrong thing to do. The best policy is policy that people locally embrace. People need to believe in the policy in order to live it. And when the president forces legislation on people, they're less likely to say, I agree with the tenets of that legislation. The president should be interested in making sure that local people feel empowered, not forced upon.
Okay, but on the other hand, does the federal government have the right to say, well, you can do whatever you want, but if you don't comply with what we are proposing, then you're going to lose your federal funding from us?
Well, I think that's still to be determined. I think, obviously, this conversation with replacing nominating a ninth justice for the Supreme Court also, you know, finds its way in the conversation. I think conversely to what you threw out there initially, Bill, you might say the federal government is finding a way to use public resources to protect minorities, right? And so I think the argument can be made. I think, you know, lawyers and judges will probably ultimately have the final say.
I think what we've got a especially here in Georgia, we've got a population that isn't there yet. And yet you've also got...
What do you mean by that?
The transgender issue is a pretty darn new one for people to be grappling with and getting their heads around. It does take some time. At the same time, over the last 50 years, you've had precedent after precedent after precedent set in federal court defining what sexuality is and what it is not. And those two don't match right now.
Yeah,
you have, and quite frankly, the Georgia legislature is a large part of setting that precedent. We had five, six, 7 years ago, we had a legislative employee, an editor of one of their legislation, decide to shift from male to female, and was fired as a result. It went through the courts. It went to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, and they said you cannot do that.
Right.
And that's part of the law that's part of the precedent that is now being applied to a new area, public schools.
All right. So, Greg Bluestein, we're going to expect that this is now going to play out. We're going to be following this through the election, beyond to the legislative session. This is going to be yet another one of the hot button social issues that is going to drive a lot of the conversation we all have in the media and among the political community, and dominate a lot of the legislative session again.
Probably. I mean, it's going to manifest itself in a few different ways. The elections, it will play a role, as we're already seeing in the primary Tuesday, in legal cases. This is going to set off a whole new round, just as Jim mentioned, of legal challenges to help more define what a person's gender is. And then, of course, next year's legislative session add yet another hot button issue to the debate.
And I'll bet you that if Donald Trump gets worried about holding on to Georgia in November, this is going to be one of his top issues.
Oh, now that's interesting.
Even though he is already it wouldn't surprise me. The Donald has been known to backpedal before on an issue, and he said last month he had no problem with transgendered people using whatever restroom they wanted. I think he might have a change of heart.
You know, I just realized as you said that, Jim, that you point out that this is a very new issue. Mm-hmm. I said on the show the other day that I think people who are still grappling with understanding the rights of gays and lesbians to marry, and now, like a Sam Olens and a Nathan Deal are saying, it's the law of the land, we should comply. You're right, Jim. There's this notion that, okay, we've got that. Oh, my gosh, then there's this brand new issue that we suddenly are asked to understand, and that's not an easy thing to grapple with. It is not to say the civil rights of transgender people don't deserve to be respected, but bringing that into the mainstream is an entirely different matter, right, Leo?
Absolutely is. It is. And you see confusing analogies being made, and with people equivocating this transgender issue to, which is a very small population of the gay community, they equivocate that issue to Jim Crowism and civil rights movement for racial justice. And, you know, again, you know, you have some people getting really upset about the gay is the new black thing and all the stuff that's surrounding learning that, you know, because there were never water fountains that said gay or straight, and, you know, yet there were that said black and white. It's creating all kinds of new conversations that we need to have.
Yeah, and Howard, it certainly, I have not heard much reaction from the African-American community, but I don't think there's any question that African-Americans who for quite a while struggled against saying gays and lesbians are dealing with civil rights in the way that, you know, Martin Luther King did, have got to be struggling with this too.
Yeah, I think it's just another dimension to what you already pointed out, which is, you know, bringing this conversation into the mainstream, let alone addressing it and through the lens of policy. So I think we'll all be waiting and seeing.
I will tell you one thing. I've got to give a shout out to Sam Mullins on the statement that he put out. He's one of the few. There have been others, but he's one of the few who have acknowledged that while we're in the midst of this public discussion about bathrooms and public schools, you're dealing with a very fragile minority of people, and that none of this discussion should devolve into harassment or hatred and such. And he was very forthright about that.
So let's close this out by picking up on something you said about presidential in November in Georgia. First of all, this is such a new issue that, despite the fact that you at the AJC did a very comprehensive statewide poll this past week or so, and you had campus carry and religious liberty, this is so new you didn't have anything about transgender individuals in there. That's how new this thing really is. So here's my question about that. Right now, the presidential campaigns are all playing out basically on the West Coast, and they remain state-to-state campaigns. But as you suggest, once the general election gets underway, there are going to be any number of states where this issue will absolutely be in play in a big way, right?
And the first clue we're going to get on that is when it ascends the stage in Cleveland.
Yeah. Okay. Well, will we hear it? Well, we'll certainly hear about it at the state party convention, as well as I'm sure it'll make a lot of there'll be a lot of noise about it there in the first weekend in June.
I would be surprised if there's not a resolution backing either what Senator McCune is proposing or just condemning Obama's
and demanding that Nathan Deal step up and do more.
Right.
That too.
All right. I'll tell you what we're going to do. Let's take a break. We do have an awful lot of presidential politics to discuss, as well as some other legislative issues, some primary election issues. But before we get to all of that, it's 2:24 on Wednesday afternoon. Let's take a break and we'll come right back.
On the next Fresh Air, Kenya Barris, the creator of the ABC sitcom Black-ish, about an African-American man who grew up poor and is now an advertising executive living in a predominantly white suburb with his wife, who's a doctor, and their four children. He thinks his privileged children don't really understand what it means to be black, and sometimes he doesn't do a good job teaching them. Join us.
Fresh Air is today at 3 on your GPB station.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Howard Franklin, Greg Bluestein, Leo Smith, and Jim Galloway are with me. Our producer, Jenny Amott, points out that beginning of the show, I talked about our station here in Atlanta, 88.5. There are a lot of you across state who are listening on the GPB signal that you get where you are, and I want to make sure you know how glad we are to have you with us as well. So let's move forward and start talking a little bit about presidential. And, of course, I think a logical starting place, Greg Bluestein, is the results of yesterday's primaries. Kentucky, which by a tiny slender of a margin, some under maybe 2,000 votes by the time it's all over with, went for Hillary Clinton while Bernie Sanders won, as people expected him to, in Oregon.
It's pretty much still status quo. I mean, Clinton has almost insurmountable lead at this point. Bernie Sanders would have to win by huge margins the few remaining contests. She has millions more votes. She has more pledged delegates. She has more superdelegates. And yet we still have this race. I think everyone's shocked and is that the Republican contest is over, yet the Democratic contest is still
going on. But we should say that at least the Clinton victory, Jim, in Kentucky stopped this streak. Yeah, the Clinton people were really breathing a sigh of relief, even if they wished it had been by more than a couple thousand votes.
Oh, I think they. I think last time I checked, it was 400 votes or more.
Oh, okay.
And they're still happy about that.
Yeah, yeah. We could expect a recount. So let's do this. Let's listen to what Bernie Sanders had to say about all this, and especially about everybody who is now saying to him, Democrats saying, get out of the race. It's Hillary Clinton's nomination.
I should tell you that there are a lot of people out there, many of the pundits and politicians, they say Bernie Sanders should drop out. The people of California should not have the right to determine who the next president will be. Well, let me be as clear as I can be. I agree with you. We are in to the last ballot is cast.
Howard Franklin, Bernie Sanders says it'll be decided in California, the last state to hold a primary in June. But hasn't it already basically been decided?
Sure. and while I think we talked a little about this before we got started on the show today, I think this is not unlike 2008. I mean, we heard similar arguments between two candidates, one who had an insurmountable lead in terms of pledged delegates, and we still had another candidate come to the convention floor and decide to release her delegates at that point. So I don't think for the amazing accomplishment that is the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016, I don't begrudge him wanting to see all the way through California.
Jim, are we going to end up with a possible scenario in which on the political rewind after the November election, when Donald Trump, in this hypothetical scenario, is the president-elect, our postmortem is going to consist of it all happened back in May when Bernie Sanders would not turn his people over to Hillary Clinton and kept fighting. He really weakened her in the general.
I don't think so. I really don't. Number one, I think there's still room in Bernie's rhetoric for him to say, okay, now we've fought that battle the best we could. Now we have to fight the November battle. I think there's still room in there, and I think the numbers. Look, the numbers speak from. I mean, she's got Hillary's only got to get what 93 more delegates, before this thing's over, and it's. I think what you see is you see a lot of the grieving process. You saw a real hard grieving process go on in Nevada over the weekend.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I think we should talk about that for a few minutes. Most people have followed this story by now, but just to recap. Nevada held its state Democratic convention. They'd had their primary election much earlier. Hillary Clinton won the lion's share of the delegates. But there were problems at the convention in Nevada in terms of the kind of rules that did not allow Sanders people felt an opportunity to be heard at the convention, to make inputs in terms of rules and that sort of thing. And it devolved into a tremendously bad situation in which finally Senator Barbara Boxer from California, who'd come as a surrogate for Hillary Clinton, tried to get up and speak, and here's what happened.
Without further ado, I present to you Senator Barbara Boxer.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I bring a message from Bernie Sanders, and I bring a message from Hillary Clinton. We need civility in the Democratic Party, civility, because the whole future of the country is at stake. Now, when you boo me, you're booing Bernie Sanders. Go ahead. You're booing Bernie Sanders. Bernie is my friend. Let's hear it for Hillary. All right, we have the vote, we have the voice, we have victory, yay! You know something? I grew up in Brooklyn. I am not afraid of bullies. I'm for Hillary Clinton, but she's for all of us. So keep on booing and boo yourselves out of this election. Go ahead.
Barbara Boxer had to finally abandon the podium. They wouldn't let her speak. I apparently am the only one in this studio who thinks this signals what could be a very tumultuous convention in Philadelphia.
Well, and just a bit of background. This is what happened in Nevada is kind of a more passionate version of what happened on the Republican side in Georgia, where you've had conventions and you had a caucus or a primary that designated the number of delegates. Now you're getting down to choose who's going to be those. So it can get very personal.
But look how calmer it has gotten since those district conventions in Georgia, sure. The Republican ones. I mean, there's still room for truce for the Democrats, and there isn't, the Democratic race is not marked by the same level of vitriol between the candidates that, let's say, Ted Cruz and Donald Trump have for each other, or Rubio and Trump. I mean, there have been some barbed words. There's at one point Senator Sanders questioned how qualified Hillary Clinton was to be a president, but hasn't been to that same level.
There's nothing has been said that would keep the two of them from appearing on the same stage.
And the beautiful thing is there's only two of them that you would have to argue, and not 17.
Howard, you know, Bernie Sanders, of course, was asked about chairs were thrown at this convention. There may have been some more scuffling, physical scuffling.
Death threats.
There were death threats against the chairwoman of the Nevada Democratic Party, who's a Clinton supporter. And Bernie Sanders, and I want to get your take as a Hillary Clinton supporter on this. He issued a statement which was surprisingly aggressive. He didn't, you know, when Donald Trump had violence at his rallies, he was held accountable by the media. He may not have responded in the best way possible. And people have tried to sort of hold Bernie Sanders a little bit accountable for this, although, of course, he wasn't there. But he didn't really say, I reject this. He said the Democratic Party has a choice. It can open its doors and welcome into the party people who are prepared to fight for real economic and social change, or blah, 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 or the party can choose to maintain its status quo structure, remain dependent on big money campaign contributions, and be a party with limited participation and energy. He essentially took advantage of that to continue his fight against the establishment Democratic Party.
I mean, that's that's media training 101, right? I'm not answering the question you're asking me. I'm answering the question I want to answer. I have a tough time, a very difficult time comparing the vitriol and the actual physical violence perpetrated at Donald Trump rallies to what happened here at the state convention in Nevada, right? We didn't have the candidate there. We might have had barbed words and actual threats, but we didn't actually have physical violence.
I think I've got to tell you, I think what's good for the goose is good for the gander, Leo Smith. I mean, the question may not be whether Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton have personal animosity to the extent that Ted Cruz and Donald Trump did, but it may be that Sanders has unleashed a grassroots network of people who are deeply passionate about his cause. And while Clinton and Sanders might find a peace, will that grassroots network, that army, find a peace?
I was asked when I was a college administrator to understand why hip-hop is played so loud, and the young man told me it's because you don't listen to me when I speak softly. And on both sides of this, Republican and Democrat, there are people who feel as though no one's been listening to them, and they want to be heard. They have the same fervor about that on the Republican side, fighting for Donald Trump, and on the other side, fighting for Bernie Sanders.
Let's listen very quickly to what the chairwoman of the Democratic National Committee, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, had to say about Bernie Sanders and his sort of non-apology.
The senator's response was anything but acceptable. It certainly did not condemn his supporters for acting violently or engaging in intimidation tactics, and instead added more fuel to the fire.
Jim?
Well, I don't know that it added more fuel to the fire. Ms. Wasserman Schultz is a Hillary partisan. I mean that goes without saying.
Yes.
And it's clear that she and Reince Priebus right now they have the toughest jobs in all of Christendom or beyond Christendom.
Yeah, it is fascinating to watch this unfold.
I agree with you, but I still take issue with the comparison. I mean, we look at what happened at these Trump rallies. We had you know, conversation that led to physical violence against certain groups of people. I think what Jim said is right. These are people who are very fervent. Leo said it. They want to be heard, and they're going to act up until they are heard.
Howard, I take your point, and you're right. There are differences, for sure. Trump incited some of the violence. Yeah. He was there. He basically targeted people in the audience. He has not rejected the kind of hate groups that have been part. So I hope I didn't suggest that he and Bernie Sanders are in the same boat here. But like Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders has refused to make a clear statement that he wants his supporters to cut this stuff out.
But if you're the chairman of the National Democratic Committee, what your worry about that about Nevada might have been is that we're going to have more Donald Trump rallies. And I would guess that a few of them are going to get out of hand. It's going to be much harder for Democrats to call out Donald Trump on that if they were unable to, if they didn't have unanimity on nonviolence at their own party.
Okay, fair enough. Somebody want to jump in?
If not, I would say, add to what Jim is saying, is that when you have more Donald Trump rallies, he has no Republican competition at this point. The people who will be the antagonists will probably likely be Democrats and liberals.
All right, Leo Smith, you're up. You wrote a piece the other day in which you predicted essentially that you believe that Donald Trump can win 20% of the African-American vote in the general election. And I assume that that means right here in Georgia, he can win a significant percentage of the African-American vote.
I'll take a little bit of that action.
I want to hear what...
Well, no, we need to hear your... Look, you on the way in here today, you pointed out that this has gotten you a lot of attention. Well, look, you're going to be on Anderson Cooper tonight. What's this about?
In this very same chair I sat during the 2013 campaign and said that Governor Deal was going to get 10% plus of the black vote.
You
and
did.
People told me I was nuts. And he got 10% of the black vote plus. Look, we're in different times politically. Political pundits have not been very good at their margins of error lately on these things. Trump is an unusual candidate. We're at an unusual time in America where there's disruption and a new corner is being turned in America. So we have polling that comes out that says that even in Georgia, we had a huge uptick, a surge in black Americans voting in the Republican primary. That polling is very obvious that is true. Now, you can't say that they're just voting in that primary because they were trying to upset the presidential race, because black people generally don't vote in primaries. I mean, the turnout is usually low for generals sometimes, so especially when there's not an Obama in the race. So here we are with black people saying, I feel invested in him. I think that we're going to see, with the proper application of economic policy, and as he starts to throw out the whole vision of him of making Americans first, including black Americans first, making their issues and their priorities important, you're going to see a wide net cast, and then you're going to see a refining of that net to make sure that black Americans, Latino Americans, see something in Donald Trump's vision for themselves.
Well, I mean, I would just start by saying, I would warn Leo on the radio not to make broad pronouncements like black people typically don't vote in primaries and general elections. African-American women actually outperform any other subgroup in the state of Georgia at polls. So all that to say, I have no idea whether or not this stuff is true, right? I don't want to weigh in and say, hey, these polls aren't true. I think what I do feel strongly about is that Donald Trump has made enough statements, enough pronouncements to all sorts of voting groups that whatever he can make up in via his celebrity with African-Americans, with young people, I think he will lose it in spades when he's talking about outreach to women, when he's talking about outreach to Hispanics, Latinos, et cetera. So I don't think this is a net benefit or net gain when it's all said and done.
Greg?
And here's a glimpse of the uphill battle that Donald Trump does face, at least in Georgia. The AJC poll that came out that we published this weekend showed that Clinton has about 81% of support among African-Americans. Trump has 9%. 7% support neither, and 3% don't know. So a lot of folks have already made up their minds.
Well, and then what's the undecided on that number? I think the undecided was like 17%.
Oh, well, among African-American voters, it was 3% don't know, 7% supporting neither. So
okay.
But
right.
And a lot can change in the next
few months. A lot can change. And so, Jim, you know, when I look at this and I look at what we saw with Governor Deal, right, and some of the disparity and disparaging concepts that were thrown out there about Governor Deal, Donald Trump has really not specifically said anything negative about Black Americans specifically.
I think you're right about that. But you talk about Deal, you know, moving between 7% and 10% is I think is progress, but certainly not a quantum leap. I think what you're proposing is what would actually be a quantum leap. And I'm not saying that Donald Trump isn't capable of it. I think he very well might be. I just think that, you know, for everything you gain, I think you lose a lot more.
Jim, sure. Number one, I would say number one, Donald Trump is no Nathan Deal. And in this last reelection, Nathan Deal was working from a series of programs.
Criminal justice reform.
Including criminal justice
charter
reform.
Charter schools.
And he had, he had been very good about going around to Black groups, to Black churches. We haven't seen Donald Trump.
And Jim, well, similarly, Hillary Clinton is not Jason Carter. This is a candidate who has deep, deep ties to the African American community.
Negative and positive.
The other part is if this race is not the runaway that Democrats want, and if it's a close one in October, you're going to see Barack Obama start to work his platform, he will be out there on the hustings for Hillary Clinton if that's the case.
Leo, just to conclude this portion of the conversation, it's a bold prediction, and we commend you for setting a goal out there. The question becomes, what are the issues? We know that one of the problems with Trump is that he doesn't do very well at coming up with specific issues. What are the issues that Trump will highlight that will attract Black voters?
Well, I would say that Trump won against a very full field of Republican challengers. I would say that he would argue that it is not a problem that he does not speak specifics about policy. Americans generally aren't interested in a politician talking about policy. If they were, they wouldn't be so interested in outsiders.
But I'm not challenging you to try to catch you on this. I'm wondering, for instance, Howard, if Trump talks a lot about the bad trade deals,
right?
If he's talking about fuller employment for Americans, and one of the ways that he believes that that will happen is if he negates things like NAFTA and doesn't enter into any other trade, will that in fact attract Black voters create new jobs?
Sure. And let's talk about the issue of cracking down on illegal immigration. The issue of making sure that American immigration laws are adhered to, like E-Verify, et cetera, and how that's going to prioritize the American citizen in the job market. That's something that will impact Black Americans, and that's something that Donald Trump is extremely strong on, probably to the extreme. He's going to refine that down, and he's going to make it make sense for the policies that exist in America that are supposed to be enforced by the federal government, and we'll see a difference for Black Americans.
Give you one shot before we go to a break.
I think 20% for Donald Trump is sort of like the wall separating the United States and Mexico. I mean, you can say it, you can fiat it, but until we actually see it, I would be skeptical.
He's going to build that wall.
I know.
Who's going to pay for it? All right. It's 2:44 in the afternoon. By the way, we're at Politics GPB. If you want to tweet us to enter our conversation, we'd love to hear from you. We're going to take our final break and come back. And let's talk a little about Megyn Kelly and Donald Trump, and then talk a little state politics.
What happens when you create an embryo that's part human and part animal, also known as a chimera?
We're not trying to make a chimera just because we want to see this kind of, monstrous creature. We're doing this for a biomedical purpose.
Scientists say it could help save thousands of lives, but others argue it crosses a line. An experiment in embryos and ethics. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 until 7 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut, Jim Galloway, Greg Bluestein, both of the AJC, Leo Smith of the State Republican Party, Howard Franklin, a Democratic political consultant, all around the table today. Let's go through a couple of the primary elections that are going to be watching in Georgia, because remember, we all go to the polls again next Tuesday, which, by the way, Jim, we've seen that apparently, at least in some counties, early voting is down considerably.
Right.
at least in part, people suggest because we've changed when Georgians go to vote in primary elections. It used to be in July.
Right. This is the first presidential election year that we will be voting in May. We've done it once before, in the 2014 race, and I think you do have a lot of people who thought they voted last time in the presidential primary.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really right. Greg?
You also don't have too many juicy statewide contests. I mean, Senator Isaacson's on the Republican primary is facing two very pretty much unknown Republican contenders, and you've got three virtual unknowns on the Democratic side, so there's not really a fiery battle there.
You all at the AJC did a terrific profile of one of the legislative races that got some attention, and that's up there in Alpharetta, where people are kind of energized around Brandon Beach, an incumbent senator who, among other things, pushed very, very hard for the expansion of MARTA, the tax that would have allowed it to come up to North Fulton County and beyond. He's got a very tough challenge on his hands, apparently, and a guy named Aaron Barlow, who may or may not be from Georgia, right?
Yeah, there's some dispute about his residency. He will say that he has proof. His daughter's birth certificates are both from Northside Hospital.
There you go.
Here, Beach is saying that you spent a couple of very precious years up in Chicago, and maybe you're not the true residence. But no legal challenge has been made. It's all been rhetoric so far. Until you see a challenge, it really doesn't matter.
One of the reasons we paid attention to that race, if I think I'm right, Greg, is because it is to some extent a referendum on how legislators who dared to want to pass the MARTA tax beyond the city of Atlanta.
Yeah, and to a lesser extent also the transportation bill from last year. I mean, Brandon Beach is a chamber guy. He's worked for the North Fulton
former
Chamber.
Head of the Alpharetta Chamber,
the
North
director.
Fulton
yeah.
Chamber.
President.
Yeah,
he's current.
Oh, he's current.
He's as chamber as you can get, and it's you know he represents what the Republican establishment used to be. The Republican Party sort of is, which is the business friendly chamber side, going up against someone who's trying to hold his feet to the fire for every sort of chamber-oriented vote he made.
Any sense of how that race is?
Well, it's a difficult district. 70% of it is in Cherokee. Both Beach and Aaron Barlow are from the North Fulton side, so they're both trying to appeal to the Cherokee, the 70% Cherokee County, which is why you've had Barlow kind of imply that Beach wants MARTA to invade Cherokee County.
Yeah,
right.
And you've had the chairman of the MARTA board saying no, we're not. We are not looking to wrap Cherokee
into
our arms.
And this is, in my opinion, this is part of what makes governing across jurisdictions difficult. You've seen Brandon as a champion of smart and thoughtful partnership on transportation, whether it is bus rapid transit or anything else underneath the Gold Dome. And that sort of thing is necessary for the region to move forward. And yet, you know, it sounds like his challenger, Barlow, is looking to really hold his feet to the fire on local issues, not on governing for the entire state.
All right, Howard, I want to turn to you because you know DeKalb politics. Another race that has attracted a good deal of interest is the race for CEO of DeKalb County, Mike Thurmond, who's been a panelist on this show until he announced he was running for office, running against a former state legislator, Connie Stokes. Where is that race headed?
I mean, well, I should also just say, full disclosure, we've hosted fundraisers for Michael. I think he certainly has built the lion's share and lead in terms of fundraising. But I think this is the big stage. DeKalb has been under scrutiny and under a lot of media attention for the last several years for a number of things that have happened. I think Thurmond has the track record that says, hey, I can go into this big organization and turn it around. He's done it with the Labor Department. He's done it with the school system. I think that he's the consensus candidate. I've not heard anything to the contrary.
Well, and one of the reasons we look at that, too, because they're fairly high-profile individuals, but also, Jim, we know DeKalb County has been under such terrible scrutiny for ethical problems, for just disorganization in the county commission. And this election, there are many who hope that this begins to turn the corner on
right.
that.
Right, and in addition to the corruption, there's just been this great racial divide between the north and south portions of the county. And Thurmond was encouraged in large part by people in North DeKalb To run, but I don't know how much they're going to participate in a Democratic primary.
Sure. You know, Thurman's got a great history in this, too, the first African-American elected to a majority white district in the state of Georgia. I've also heard from folks in Central and North DeKalb there's a lot of support for him, but I hear what you're saying. I don't know how many Democratic ballots.
We're going to talk more about some of the other races that are on the ballot next Tuesday on Friday's show, including, by the way, we're going to look at the constitutional amendments that are on the ballot, and we'll do all that at 3 o'clock on Political Rewind on Friday. But in the meantime, let's, with the time we have left, just take a few minutes to talk about this kind of odd and fascinating interview that Megyn Kelly did with Donald Trump last night.
I have great respect for you that you were able to call me and say, let's get together and let's talk. To me, I would not have done that. I don't say that as an, you know, as a positive. I think it's a negative for me. And you walk into Trump Tower, we didn't have, like, on a neutral site or over at Fox or something. That would be a whole different thing, and I wouldn't have done it.
I think the doormen are still recovering.
I think the whole building's recovering. You know, people going like, this can't be possible, right?
All right, so we all know the history. Donald Trump has been attacking Megyn Kelly ever since the first debate when she questioned him about the comments that he's made about women over the years. Jim Galloway, I wanted to talk about it from two points of view. One of them is, did Trump acquit himself well? And he certainly had a different posture. But also, as a journalist, it sort of made me squirm to watch this interview.
Yeah, it was, it's TV. I don't understand TV. Look, I will admit that. But, you know, if you're in print or in radio, I've had decades to experience this. I wouldn't blink. If somebody and I are having an argument and I need that person for another news story, I've got no problem with calling him up.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think so. Here's why, Greg, I wanted to hear the journalists on this, especially. You know, Megyn Kelly has done a terrific job in much of her reporting. I mean, her debate questions have been good. I mean, she's been tough.
Yeah,
and yet she's put in this very difficult position where Trump has whipped up a frenzy against her, and now he's going to be the nominee of the party. And I do think there's a special TV-related issue around this that she's kind of almost like a hostage in that interview last night. Does that make sense?
Well, and also she has a book coming out. Her contract with Fox is about to expire, so she's got a big contract negotiation coming up. So there's different reasons for that as
and,
well.
And if Trump should make it to the White House, they need access.
Yeah,
she's
yeah.
the access.
Do either of you, Leo or Howard, sense that was a little bit awkward to watch last night?
I'll let you chime in.
There's a lot more awkward moments to come.
He's right about that.
You do have to say that Trump comported himself about as well as you possibly could in this conversation.
You might even say that he seemed humbly presidential.
Yeah, let's listen to a little bit of the way when Megyn Kelly asked him whether he has any regrets.
So when you look back on the past 9 months from that first debate to now, any regrets?
Absolutely, I have regrets. I don't think I want to discuss what the regrets are, but absolutely, I could have done certain things differently. I could have maybe used different language in a couple of instances. But overall, I have to be very happy with the outcome. And I think if I didn't conduct myself in the way I've done it, I don't think I would have been successful, actually. If I were soft, if I were, you know, presidential, okay, presidential. It's, in a way, it's a bad word because there's nothing wrong with being presidential. But if I would not have fought back the way I fought back, I don't think I would have been successful.
Leo, you held up your arms in a cheer when you heard him say that. But here's the question. Everybody who talks about all the your friends in the Republican Party, you say it's time for him to change his tone. I think Donald Trump sent another message last night that I got where I am because of who I am. If you're looking for me to change, forget about it.
Well, I don't think he's saying that he isn't going to change. He says he's going to play the game according to the rules that are present at the time of action. And that action was winning the presidential primary, and he did. And he did things to get attention, to get free media, etc. That's part of his strategy. And we got to understand that he says these are the rules that you've set forth. This is we've got a consumer market for sensational action. And that's what people want. So he gave it to him and won.
I guess the question that remains is, how large is that consumer market? It might seem disproportionately large inside of a Republican Party, but I don't know how large it is in the whole of the American electorate. And I think that's the question.
Well, that is the question, and we shall see how that unfolds through November.
And the 60 to 70% of women who consistently give him, you know, unfavorable reviews in polls, including the AJC poll, that's the other question, too, is as he shifts, does this sort of hard-edge thing, he got this far because he didn't go soft, will that work in a general election against what could be the first female president?
He has a sort of hip-hop swagger, okay? And it's bold. And
it says this is another reason you think he's going to win the black vote.
I used to be sort of anti-hip-hop a little bit, this gangster rap. And people say, well, Leo, it's just music, it's entertainment. But it got people's attention. And people who were reasonable, good-thinking people, who were good people, who were not misogynistic, who did not hate police and want to kill police, they listened to it for entertainment. He plays like that.
Yeah, that's a great point. To keep the music analogy going on, and Drake just dropped a great album, million sold. You know, last year Adele sold 25 million. If I had to count checks from one of the two artists, right, and to figure out who's the more mainstream, I hate to say it, but I think Adele would win there.
How big though is Drake? He's beaten Beyonce.
That's true.
All right, look, we're just about out of time for this edition of Political Rewind. The music reviews will start after we're off the air, but really appreciate Howard Franklin, your being here, Leo Smith. Pleasure to have both of you here. We're going to watch you over the months ahead for your prediction of 20% black vote for Donald Trump here in Georgia and across the country. Greg Bluestein, always great to have you here from the AJC. And Jim Galloway.
Next week, we're going to talk Bing Crosby.
All right. So we do have a show coming up at 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon. And Todd Rehm is going to be here, our good friend at GeorgiaPundit.com. He's been really studying up on these constitutional amendments that have gotten almost no attention at all, and is going to talk with us about them as well as other aspects of the primary race. And Steve Henson, the leader of the Georgia Democrats in the state Senate, will be here for that show as well. I just want to remind you that if you're not near a radio, you know, we love having you listen when we're on the air because it's good for the ratings when you do. But people are always asking, gee, I missed the show. Is there any way to hear it? Yes, there are a couple ways. Number one, you can download or you can subscribe really to the Political Rewind podcast. On iTunes, you can download the GPB Atlanta app and listen to the show there. And we're also on the website at gpb.org. So there's all sorts of ways you can listen when you're not near a radio when we're on the air. Our producer is the extraordinary Jenny Ament. We thank you for your work. Thanks to all of you for being with us today for Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. See you again on Friday afternoon.